Mary Magdalene, faithful witness and beloved disciple, I call to you. Bearer of sacred devotion and keeper of hidden wisdom, draw near. You who stood at the cross and walked in the garden of resurrection, guide my heart in courage and truth. Teach me the power of love that does not turn away from suffering. Awaken within me the wisdom that sees beyond fear and illusion. May your devotion ignite clarity, compassion, and spiritual sight within my soul. Mary Magdalene, Apostle of the Risen Light, walk beside me now. The sun had barely lifted itself above the horizon when Mary Magdalene turned back toward the city. The garden was still damp with the night, the scent of earth heavy in the air. She had gone to tend to the dead, to perform the small loving acts that grief still allows when hope has already been buried. What she did not expect was to be spoken to by the living. When she ran to tell the others what she'd seen, what she'd been told, her words didn't land as revelation. They landed as disturbance, a woman claiming vision, a woman claiming instruction, a woman claiming authority. The men listened, but they didn't follow. Some of them doubted, some of them dismissed, some grew uneasy at the implication that the first witness to resurrection was not one of them. Mary stood at the threshold of a truth that would change the world, holding a message too alive to be contained and too dangerous to be trusted. This is where her story begins, not in scandal, not in silence, but in the ancient and familiar place where women who know are asked to prove that knowing again and again. Who is Mary Magdalene? Mary Magdalene appears in all four canonical Gospels, which alone places her amongst the most consistently attested figure in the Jesus movement. She's named more frequently than most of the male disciples and is present at the crucifixion. She's present at the burial and the resurrection, moments where many of the others disappear. The Gospel of Luke tells us that Jesus cast out seven demons from her, a phrase long misinterpreted as moral failing, rather than what it most likely was in its historical context, a reference to profound psychological or spiritual affliction, possibly trauma, or even illness. In the Gospel of John, Mary Magdalene is the first to encounter the risen Christ. He speaks her name, and she recognizes him, not by sight, but by voice. This moment is not incidental. In ancient Jewish thought, to know someone's name and to be called by name was an act of intimate recognition. She is then instructed to go and tell the others. This makes her, in the earliest tradition, Apostola Apostolorum, the apostles to the apostles. It's important to already deviate here to discuss the invention of the prostitute misconception. For nearly 1500 years, Mary Magdalene was widely known in Western Christianity as a repentant prostitute, a fallen woman redeemed by the mercy of Christ. Paintings, sermons, literature, and even modern films repeated this story so often that it became part of the cultural imagination. But here's the surprising truth. The New Testament never calls Mary Magdalene a prostitute. In fact, the Gospels describe something very different. They tell us that Mary Magdalene was a devoted disciple, a supporter of Jesus' ministry, a witness to the crucifixion when many others had already fled, and the first person to encounter the risen Christ on the morning of the resurrection. In the earliest Christian memory, she wasn't known as a sinner who was seeking forgiveness. She was known as the one who carried the first proclamation of Easter, the one who told the apostles that death had been overcome. So how did the story change so dramatically? How did a woman remembered as the first witness to the resurrection become for centuries the symbol of sexual sin and repentance? And why did the church eventually reverse that interpretation nearly 1400 years later? The conflation of Mary Magdalene with a repentant prostitute is one of the most enduring distortions in Christian history. It was formalized in the 6th century by Pope Gregory I, who merged Mary Magdalene with unnamed sinful women from other gospel passages. This interpretation hardened into doctrine and persisted for over 1,000 years. But why? Because sexual shame is an effective way to neutralize spiritual authority. A woman framed as redeemed through forgiveness, rather than respected for wisdom, can be admired without being followed. Her power becomes emotional instead of instructional. The church formally corrected this error in 1969, quietly removing the identification of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute from his liturgy. By then, the damage had already shaped cultural memory. So what do we actually know then about Mary Magdalene if we know that she's not the prostitute? Well, let's look to the Gospel of Mary, which in that Gospel, there's a very different kind of authority figure here. The Gospel of Mary, which was discovered in the late 19th century and preserved in the Berlin Codex, it offers a radically different portrayal. This text doesn't present Mary as a passive recipient of grace, but as a teacher of inner knowledge. In the Gospel of Mary, she comforts the disciples after Jesus' departure, explaining teachings that he gave her privately. She speaks of the soul's ascent, she speaks of liberation from fear, and of the false authority of external powers. We see in this Gospel that Peter challenges her legitimacy, and it's Levi who ends up stepping forward to defend her. And this conflict is quite explicit. It's not theological abstraction. It's a struggle over authority. Mary's knowledge is experiential. It's an interior type of knowledge, and it's quite direct. It doesn't rely on hierarchy or institutional sanction. One line particularly stands out from the Gospel. She says, "Where the mind is, there is the treasure." This is not a call to obedience, but to inner discernment. Mary Magdalene's voice in the Gospel of Mary is really unlike almost any other Christian text. Instead of focusing on sin, obedience, or doctrine, it describes the journey of the soul through layers of illusion that obscure its divine nature. What Mary shares with the disciples after the departure of Jesus is not merely a memory of his teachings, but a vision, a mystical cosmology of the soul's ascent beyond forces that bind consciousness to fear and confusion. The text survives only in fragments, yet within those fragments is a profound teaching. Mary recounts a vision in which the soul rises upward after death and encounters 7 hostile powers, each representing a distortion of perception that keeps the soul trapped in ignorance. These are sometimes called the 7 powers of wrath or the 7 forms of illusion. Rather than seeing them only as a cosmic force after death, many mystics interpret them as psychological and spiritual patterns that we encounter in life right now. They are the illusions that keep us from remembering who we are. In that sense, Mary Magdalene isn't describing something that happens after death alone. She's describing the awakening of consciousness while we are alive. The journey that she outlines is a process of recognizing and dissolving the layers that cover the divine spark within us. Let's talk about the first layer, because the first layer is darkness. Darkness is the state in which the soul forgets its origin. It is not evil in itself. It's the condition of not remembering. In the Gospel of Mary, darkness is the first power that confronts the ascending soul and demands to know where it has come from. So in modern life, darkness often appears as the feeling of being cut off from meaning. It shows up as spiritual numbness, cynicism, or even the belief that life is purely mechanical. It's the sense that there's no deeper purpose behind existence. People living in this layer may feel restless, but unable to really articulate why. They may distract themselves constantly through entertainment, work, or endless stimulation because silence would force them to face the emptiness that they feel. Healing this layer begins with remembrance. Mary's teachings suggest that the awakening begins the moment that the soul says, "I come from the realm of light." In practice, this might mean cultivating moments of quiet when we reconnect with the deeper awareness beneath our thoughts, meditation, contemplative prayer, journaling, or simply sitting with the mystery of being alive can start to dissolve this darkness. It is the act of remembering the consciousness itself is sacred. The second layer is desire. In the Gospel of Mary, desire attempts to hold the soul back by claiming that it belongs to the realm of material longing. Desire in this sense is not simply wanting things. It is the compulsive attachment that convinces us we cannot be whole without something external. In modern life, desire saturates our culture. Entire industries are built on convincing us that fulfillment is always one purchase, one relationship, or even one achievement away. We're taught to measure our worth by how much we acquire or how desirable we appear to be to others. This illusion becomes painful because it keeps the soul chasing satisfaction that never fully arrives. Desire promises completion, but it delivers only temporary relief. Healing this layer doesn't require rejecting pleasure or even beauty. Instead, it involves learning to observe desire without becoming enslaved to it. Practices like mindfulness, conscious consumption, and honest self-inquiry help reveal when we are acting from genuine joy and when we are chasing approval or validation. Mary's vision suggests that the soul moves beyond desire when it realizes that its essence is already complete. The third layer is ignorance. Ignorance in the Gospel of Mary is not a lack of intelligence. It's the belief that reality is exactly what it appears to be on the surface. It is the refusal to question inherited assumptions about the world, about God, and about ourselves. Ignorance often manifests today as some form of rigid certainty. It appears when people cling to ideologies, whether these are religious, political, or even cultural, without examining whether those beliefs actually lead to compassion or wisdom. From a spiritual perspective, ignorance is the illusion that truth is something handed down by authority rather than something discovered through inner awakening. Healing this layer requires curiosity. It asks us to become students again. Students who study sacred texts, who explore different spiritual traditions, and asking difficult questions, all of that helps to dissolve ignorance. Mary herself embodies this process. In the Gospel, the male disciples struggle with doubt and fear while Mary speaks from a place of direct insight. Her authority comes not from hierarchy, but from experience of the divine. The fourth layer is jealousy. Jealousy is one of the most human illusions because it arises from comparison. When the soul forgets its unique expression of the divine, it begins to measure itself against others. In modern life, jealousy is amplified by social media and competitive cultures. We see curated versions of other people's lives and assume that they're happier, that they're more successful, or more spiritually advanced than we are. Jealousy fractures community. It turns spiritual paths into competitions and relationships even into rivalries. Healing this layer involves reclaiming the understanding that each soul expresses the divine in a different way. Practices of gratitude and compassion help shift the focus from comparison to appreciation. Mary Magdalene herself becomes a target of jealousy in later Christian traditions. Her spiritual authority threatened existing power structures, and over time, her story was distorted. In that sense, the Gospel of Mary can be seen as a radical challenge to jealousy-based hierarchies. The fifth layer is the kingdom of the flesh. This power represents identification, with the body as the entirety of the self. In the ancient world, this did not mean that the body was bad, but rather, it meant that mistaking ourselves solely for our physical form leads to fear of death and obsessive control. In modern culture, this illusion appears in so many ways. It shows up in the pressure to achieve perfect bodies, in the fear of aging, and in the idea that our value is determined by our appearance or our productivity. When the body becomes the center of identity, mortality feels like annihilation. Healing this layer requires a shift in perspective. Spiritual traditions across the world teach that the body is a vessel of consciousness, not the entirety of who we are. Practices like yoga, breathwork, and somatic awareness can actually deepen this realization because they help us to inhabit the body while also sensing the consciousness that moves through it. The body becomes then not a prison, but a sacred instrument. The sixth layer is the foolish wisdom of the flesh. This power is a little bit more subtler. It refers to the kind of knowledge that appears wise, but ultimately keeps us trapped in superficial understanding. It's the belief that intellectual knowledge alone is enough. In modern life, this illusion appears in the tendency to collect spiritual information without transformation. People may sit around and read countless books, they listen to countless podcasts, they attend workshops, and they still remain disconnected from the actual practice of awakening. Knowledge becomes a substitute, in the sense, for experience. Mary's teachings challenges this directly. Her vision suggests that true wisdom is not about accumulating ideas, but about direct realization of the soul's nature. Healing this layer means integrating what we learn. Instead of endlessly searching for the next teaching, we return to the practices that cultivate awareness, these being meditation, ethical living, compassion, and even honesty with ourselves. Wisdom becomes embodied rather than theoretical. The seventh and final layer is wrathful wisdom. This last power is often interpreted as the most dangerous because it disguises itself as righteousness. It's the conviction that one's own understanding is so correct that it justifies anger, domination, or exclusion. History shows how destructive this illusion can be. Wars, persecutions, and spiritual abuse often arise when people believe that they are defending absolute truth. In your personal life, wrathful wisdom appears when you begin to cling to being right. It surfaces in arguments where the goal is not understanding, yet the goal in the sense is victory. The soul passes beyond this final power when it realizes that divine wisdom is inseparable from compassion. In the Gospel of Mary, the liberated soul finally declares that it's been freed from the illusions that once bound it. It returns to the realm of rest, not as an escape from the world, but as a return to its original nature. What makes Mary Magdalene's teaching so powerful is that it reframes the spiritual path. Instead of focusing on sin and punishment, it focuses on awakening from illusion. Each layer is not an enemy, but a teacher revealing where we have forgotten who we are. Darkness reminds us to seek meaning. Desire reveals our hunger for wholeness. Ignorance invites curiosity. Jealousy calls us back to our unique path. The kingdom of the flesh teaches us to honor, but not reduce ourselves to the body. Foolish wisdom asks us to embody what we learn. Wrathful wisdom transforms into compassion. Seen this way, Mary Magdalene's gospel becomes a map of inner liberation. It describes the gradual unveiling of the soul until it recognizes what always was true, that beneath every layer of illusion is a consciousness that cannot be destroyed. It cannot be diminished or separated from the divine. And perhaps this is why Mary's voice was so controversial in the early church. She wasn't simply repeating teachings. She was describing a direct path to awakening, one that did not depend on hierarchy or intermediaries. It began with the vision, but its real destination was the transformation of how we live here and now. So why was her gospel so threatening? The Gospel of Mary undermines three pillars of institutional control. Number one, exclusive authority. Number two, mediated salvation. And number three, gender hierarchy. It teaches that salvation is not achieved through adherence to law or doctrine, but through awakening to the soul's true nature. This kind of teaching does not require priests. It doesn't require empire. And it doesn't require compliance, rather, it requires maturity. Elaine Pagels notes that texts like the Gospel of Mary were excluded, not because they were incoherent, but because they were too coherent in a way that threatened emerging orthodoxy. When Mary Magdalene speaks in the Gospel of Mary, her authority has a distinctly different quality from what we see in many other early Christian texts. She doesn't attempt to establish dominance over the other disciples, nor does she defend her status through argument or hierarchy. Instead, she speaks quietly and with certainty as someone who has already experienced the truth that she herself is describing. And this difference is significant. In many religious traditions, authority is derived from position, priest, bishop, teacher, or apostle. But Mary's authority comes from gnosis, a Greek word that means direct knowing. It's knowledge that arises from experience rather than through instruction. When she describes the vision that she received from the risen Christ, she's not presenting a doctrine to be enforced. She's sharing insight gained through interior revelation. That kind of authority can be unsettling to systems that are built on rank and institutional legitimacy. A person who speaks from inner realization doesn't need permission to do so. They don't rely on titles, and they cannot easily be controlled by structures that determine who is allowed to speak and who must remain silent. In the narrative of the Gospel of Mary, this tension becomes quite visible when some of the male disciples question her credibility. Peter, in particular, expresses doubt that the Savior would reveal teachings to a woman privately. His objection is not really about the content of her message. It's about the disruption of the expected order. Mary doesn't respond with defensiveness. She simply continues to recount what she has seen. This composure is characteristic of wisdom teachers throughout history. Their presence itself challenges assumptions about authority. They don't need to win debates because their teaching emerges from a deeper orientation to reality. In the case of Mary Magdalene, the vision that she describes reframes the entire nature of the spiritual path. In her account, the risen Christ teaches that sin is not primarily a moral violation, but a state of separation. The Greek term, often translated as sin in early Christian writings, or hamartia, it literally means missing the mark. In Mary's gospel, the mark is not obedience to an external rule, but recognition of one's true nature. The problem facing humanity is not that we are inherently corrupt, but that we have forgotten who we are. This idea radically alters the meaning of salvation. If sin is fundamentally ignorance or misperception, then healing cannot come through punishment or coercion. It must come through remembrance, the gradual awakening to the divine presence that is already within the human soul. In this sense, Mary's teachings aligns closely with older wisdom traditions that were circulating throughout the Mediterranean world during the first centuries of the Common Era. Philosophical schools such as Platonism, certain strands of Jewish mysticism, and later Christian contemplative traditions, they all share the idea that the soul originates in a divine realm and becomes entangled in illusion. Liberation comes not through external authority, but through the restoration of awareness. Mary Magdalene's Christianity, therefore, feels less like an institutional religion and more like a path of inner transformation. The teachings that she transmits, they emphasize the journey of the soul, the dissolution of illusion, and the rediscovery of the divine spark within. These are themes that resonate strongly within the language of mystics throughout history, all the way from desert fathers to medieval visionaries and contemplatives. Her role in this context begins to look less like that of a disciple repeating instructions and more like that of a wisdom teacher guiding others through an interior landscape. She embodies a spirituality that is reflective, experiential, and deeply embodied. The emphasis is not on rejecting the world, but on perceiving it differently, seeing through the layers of fear and misunderstanding that currently and have always obscured the sacredness of life. This orientation places her closer to the mystics than to the administrators of institutional religion. Mystics are often concerned with the transformation of consciousness, the direct encounter with the divine, and the subtle work of integrating spiritual insight into daily life. Administrators, by contrast, are responsible for preserving structure, doctrine, and communal order. Both roles can be important, but they operate according to very different priorities. Mary's voice clearly belongs to the first category. Her authority arises from lived experience and the capacity to articulate that experience in a way that awakens others. In this light, the tension between Mary and some of the other disciples in that text reflects a deeper question that has appeared repeatedly in religious history. Should spiritual authority come from institutions or from awakened individuals? And the Gospel of Mary quietly suggests that the deepest authority is the one that emerges when a person remembers their origins in the divine. So let's ask ourselves why her gospel was hidden for such a long time. When people first encounter texts like the Gospel of Mary, it can be tempting to imagine a dramatic moment when church leaders deliberately suppress them, sealing them away in some sort of secret vault. The historical reality is more gradual and in many ways is a little bit more complex. During the first few centuries after the death of Jesus, Christianity was not a single unified tradition. It was a diverse movement that was made up of many communities that spread across the Mediterranean world. These communities shared certain stories and beliefs about Jesus, but they often interpreted his teachings in very different ways. Some groups emphasized strict adherence to moral teachings and even communal structure. Others focused on mystical insight, symbolic interpretations of scripture, or the inner transformation of the soul. Different communities produced different texts reflecting their understanding of the message. The Gospel of Mary appears to have emerged from one of these more contemplative circles often associated today with what scholars would call Gnostic Christianity. These communities tended to emphasize inner knowledge, visionary experience, and the idea that divine truth could be encountered directly within the human heart. As Christianity grew and spread, however, leaders began to recognize the need for shared teachings that could unify believers across regions. Questions naturally arose. Which writings should be considered authoritative? Which interpretations best represented the message of Jesus? Over several centuries, church leaders debated these issues. Texts that were widely used in worship and teaching gradually became recognized as canonical, while others were set aside. This process was not purely theological. It was also shaped by practical concerns about cohesion, leadership, and the survival of the movement. By the 4th century, a major shift occurred when Christianity moved from being a persecuted minority religion to one that was closely aligned with imperial power. After Emperor Constantine legalized Christianity in the early 300s, the church suddenly found itself responsible not only for guiding spiritual life, but also for helping stabilize a vast empire. In that context, unity became extremely important. A religion that was internally fragmented could threaten social and political stability. Church leaders therefore worked to establish a more standardized set of teachings that communities across the empire could share. Teachings that emphasized clear hierarchy, shared doctrine, and obedience to established authority were easier to integrate into this emerging structure. Texts that highlighted individual revelation or inner authority were more difficult to regulate. They could encourage interpretations that varied widely from place to place, making them harder to integrate into a unified framework. The Gospel of Mary falls into this latter category. Its central message that the soul can encounter divine truth directly and that spiritual authority arises from inner insight does not rely heavily on institutional mediation. For communities that valued mystical experience, this teaching was deeply meaningful. For leaders attempting to create a cohesive church structure across the empire, it presented challenges. As a result, texts like Mary's were not necessarily banned outright in every case. Instead, they were gradually excluded from the official canon, they were copied less frequently, and eventually faded from common circulation. Over time, many of them survived only in isolated manuscripts preserved by particular communities or buried in collections of writings that were hidden during periods of conflict. This is why so many early Christian texts were rediscovered in the modern era through archaeological finds. The Gospel of Mary itself survived in fragmentary form within a 5th century Coptic manuscript discovered in the late 19th century. Other writings with similar themes were found in 1945 in the famous Nag Hammadi Library in Egypt, where a collection of ancient codices had been sealed inside a jar and buried for centuries. These discoveries revealed that Christianity contained far more diversity than later traditions had remembered. The survival of Mary Magdalene's voice in these fragments suggests something quite remarkable here. Even as certain interpretations became dominant, other strands of the tradition continued quietly in the background, copied by monks, preserved in small communities, or rediscovered by seekers who sensed that the story of early Christianity was larger than the official narrative. In that sense, the Gospel of Mary was not simply hidden. It was waiting. Waiting for a time when readers might again be open to its message of inner awakening and spiritual remembrance. Today, as these ancient texts become more widely known, Mary Magdalene's voice is once again entering the conversation. Her gospel invites modern readers to consider a form of Christianity that is contemplative rather than coercive, transformative rather than merely institutional. And perhaps that's why her story continues to resonate. Beneath centuries of interpretation, many people still feel the intuition that something essential about the earliest spiritual teachings may have been quieter, more interior, and more liberating than the structures that later grew around them. Mary's fragments give us a glimpse of that possibility. So for centuries, people have wondered what became of Mary Magdalene after the death of Jesus. The canonical gospel tells us that she witnessed the crucifixion when many others fled. They tell us that she came to the tomb at dawn and encountered the risen Christ in the garden. In the Gospel of John, she becomes the first person to recognize the resurrection and is sent to tell the others what she has seen. And then almost suddenly, the historical record grows quiet. The New Testament doesn't describe where Mary Magdalene traveled to afterward, or what role that she played in the early Christian movement, or even how the rest of her life unfolded. For a woman who appears so prominently in the most pivotal moment of the Christian story, her later life remains largely unrecorded in the canonical text. The silence left space for centuries of speculation, tradition, and storytelling. Some early Christian writings suggest that she continued teaching among the followers of Jesus. In certain Gnostic texts, she appears as a visionary figure who receives spiritual insight and shares it with the disciples. Other traditions place her in the Eastern Mediterranean, continuing the work of the early Christian community. But another tradition, one that took deep root in medieval Europe, tells a very different story. According to this memory, Mary Magdalene eventually traveled far from the lands of Judea and arrived on the southern coast of what is now France. It is within this tradition that a fascinating portrait of Magdalene emerges, one that presents her not only as a follower of Jesus, but as a contemplative mystic and spiritual teacher whose life came to resemble the ancient archetype of the oracle priestess. One of the most influential sources preserving this story appears in the medieval text known as the Golden Legend. The Golden Legend was written around the year 1260 by a Dominican archbishop in Italy, and it was a collection of saints' lives and sacred narratives that became one of the most widely read books in Europe during the Middle Ages. For centuries, it circulated through monasteries, churches, and households, shaping how ordinary people imagined the lives of the saints. Within its pages appears a remarkable account of Mary Magdalene that most modern readers rarely encounter. According to this narrative, after the death and resurrection of Jesus, the early followers of the new faith faced intense persecution. Mary Magdalene, along with several companions, including Lazarus, Martha, Mary Salome, and Mary Jacobi, was captured by hostile authorities. Instead of executing them, the authorities devised another form of punishment. They placed the group into a small boat without sails or oars and pushed it out into the open sea. The intention was simple. Without navigation or supplies, the sea itself would finish the work. But the story says the boat did not sink. Carried only by currents and what the text describes as divine providence, the vessel drifted across the Mediterranean until it reached the southern coast of Gaul in what is now France. The group eventually landed at a small coastal settlement that later became known as Sainte-Marie de la Mer. From that moment, the companions began to disperse across the region. Lazarus traveled north to Marseille, where he later became associated with the early Christian community and was remembered in tradition as a bishop. Martha journeyed inland to Tarascon, where legends describe her teaching and performing miracles. Mary Magdalene, however, chose a very different path. According to the Golden Legend, she withdrew almost completely from society and retreated into the rugged mountains of Provence. There she discovered a remote cave high on the slopes of a mountain known today as Saint-Baume. In that cave, the story says, she lived for 30 years. The description of her life there is quite extraordinary. The text explains that she devoted herself entirely to contemplation, to fasting, and prayer, yet it also includes a striking mystical element. Each day, according to the legend, angels lifted her from the cave and carried her upward so that she could hear the music of heaven before returning her once again to the earth. The text describes it this way. Each day she was raised by angels into the air and heard the glorious songs of heaven. For medieval readers, this description wasn't necessarily meant to be interpreted as literal flight through the sky. Instead, it reflected the language of mystical ecstasy, the belief that a contemplative could become so absorbed in divine presence that the soul seemed to rise beyond the limits of ordinary perception. In other words, Magdalene was portrayed not simply as a hermit seeking repentance, but as someone who had entered a state of profound and continuous mystical union. Near the end of her life, the legend continues, a local priest named Maximinus discovered her in the wilderness. When he encountered her, she appeared thin from years of fasting yet radiant with spiritual presence. He brought her to receive the Eucharist, and soon afterwards she died and was buried in the region. Whether every detail of this narrative is historically accurate is difficult to determine. What is clear, however, is that the tradition itself became enormously influential. For centuries, pilgrims traveled to the mountain of Saint-Baume to visit the cave where Magdalene was believed to have lived. Kings, monks, mystics, and ordinary seekers climbed the forest path that leads to the cavern, entering the quiet interior to pray. The cave itself became a kind of sanctuary. Pilgrims believed that the contemplative presence Magdalene had cultivated there had somehow permeated the landscape itself. To sit within the cave was to enter the silence that she had once inhabited. Yet there is another layer to the story that becomes visible when we step back and consider the symbolism of caves within the ancient Mediterranean world. Long before Christianity spread across Europe, caves were often regarded as sacred places of initiation. In Greek religious traditions, many oracles and mystery cults were associated with caves or underground chambers. These spaces represented thresholds between worlds, places where one descended into darkness in order to encounter hidden knowledge. One of the most famous examples is the Oracle of Delphi. The priestess known as the Pythia delivered prophetic messages from a chamber within the temple complex that was built over a fissure in the earth. Ancient writers frequently describe the chamber as subterranean or even cave-like. From this hidden place, the priestess entered an altered state and spoke the words of the god Apollo. Across the Mediterranean world, similar patterns appear again and again. Sacred caves function as spaces where priestesses, prophets, and initiates enter darkness in order to encounter divine revelation. The symbolism was powerful. To enter a cave was to descend into the womb of the earth. It represented death to the old self and rebirth into deeper knowledge. When we return to the story of Mary Magdalene in Provence, the parallels become difficult to ignore. Here we encounter a woman associated with spiritual revelation who withdraws into a mountain cave. She spends decades in contemplative practice and emerges as a figure of wisdom whose presence draws seekers from distant lands. The pattern closely resembles the structure of ancient oracle traditions. The landscape itself adds another intriguing dimension. The Saint-Baume region has been considered sacred long before Christianity arrived there. Archaeological evidence suggests that the mountains and forests of Provence were connected to earlier Mediterranean goddess traditions, possibly linked to Artemis and other feminine divinities across the wilderness sanctuaries. Throughout religious history, it's common for sacred sites to be adopted by new traditions while preserving older symbolic meanings. In that sense, Magdalene's cave may represent the Christian continuation of a much older spiritual geography. Within the Christian narrative, Magdalene's authority comes from her relationship with Jesus and her role as the first witness of the resurrection. Yet, in the medieval imagination, she also became something more. She was a contemplative who withdrew into the wilderness, a woman whose spiritual insight drew pilgrims across centuries, and a figure whose sacred landscape mirrored the ancient spaces where oracles once spoke. The convergence of these traditions suggests that Mary Magdalene occupies a unique place in spiritual history. She stands at a crossroads between early Christian mysticism and the older Mediterranean archetype of the feminine wisdom bearer. This may help explain why her story continues to resonate so deeply today. In the gospel narratives, Magdalene is the one who recognizes the risen Christ when others do not. She hears her name spoken in the garden and realizes that death has not had the final word. In the medieval legends, she becomes the contemplative mystic who withdraws into the silence of a cave and spends decades listening to the music of heaven. Both images express the same underlying transformation. Mary Magdalene represents the moment when perception shifts, when the soul moves beyond fear and begins to recognize the divine presence hidden within the ordinary world. The Garden of Resurrection and the Cave of Contemplation are not so different. Both are places where the boundary between heaven and earth grows incredibly thin. Perhaps that's why pilgrims still climb that mountain today. They're not only honoring a saint from the past, they're entering a landscape shaped by centuries of longing for the same transformation Magdalene herself embodied. The journey inward into silence, where the voice of the sacred can finally be heard. So why does Mary Magdalene matter today? Mary Magdalene's voice carries a particular resonance in the present moment because many people are experiencing a profound crisis of trust in spiritual authority. Across cultures, institutions that once defined religious life, churches, hierarchies, official interpreters of sacred texts, they no longer hold the unquestioned legitimacy that they once did. Scandals, dogmatic rigidity, and the sense that spiritual authority has too often been used to control rather than liberate have really left many people disillusioned. At the same time, the hunger for meaning has not disappeared. If anything, it has intensified. People are searching for ways to reconnect with the sacred that feel honest, embodied, and psychologically integrated. They're asking questions that echo across countless conversations today. How do we discern truth for ourselves? What does authentic spiritual authority look like? How can faith be lived without surrendering personal conscience and experience? This is precisely the space where Mary Magdalene's teaching becomes strikingly relevant. In the Gospel of Mary, wisdom doesn't descend through force or domination. It emerges through intimacy with truth. Mary receives a vision, contemplates it, and shares it with others. She doesn't command them to accept it. She offers insight and invites them into a deeper understanding of themselves. Her authority is relational rather than hierarchical. This approach feels radically different from many models of spiritual leadership that people have encountered. Instead of positioning the teacher as the unquestionable gatekeeper of truth, Mary embodies a form of guidance that awakens the capacity for knowing within others. Her role resembles that of a midwife of awareness, someone who helps others recognize what is already present in their own consciousness. For a modern people who are trying to navigate the collapse or transformation of traditional religious structures, this model offers a way forward. It suggests that authentic spirituality doesn't require abandoning discernment or even personal experience. Instead, it asks individuals to cultivate a deeper relationship with their own interior awareness. Another reason Mary's voice resonates today is that her teaching doesn't reject the human body or the realm of desire. Many religious traditions historically treated the body as a source of temptation or corruption that had to be subdued. In contrast, the mystical perspective found in the Gospel of Mary frames the problem not as the existence of desire, but as the confusion that arises when desire becomes entangled with illusion. In other words, the issue is not that humans experience longing, pleasure, or embodiment. The issue is forgetting the deeper origin of those experiences. When the soul identifies entirely with its appetites or fears, it becomes trapped in cycles of attachment and dissatisfaction. But when awareness deepens, the body and its desires are no longer enemies. They become part of the living field through which consciousness itself is expressed. This perspective is particularly meaningful in a cultural moment when many people are reclaiming a more integrated relationship with the body. Practices such as somatic therapy, contemplative movement, breathwork, and trauma-informed spirituality all recognize that healing doesn't occur by transcending the body, but by inhabiting it more fully. Mary's teachings resonates with this shift because it doesn't call for spiritual escape, it calls for clarity. Equally important is her refusal to outsource knowing. In the narrative of the Gospel of Mary, the disciples are distressed after the departure of Jesus. They fear persecution, they fear uncertainty. Mary steps forward, not by asserting superiority, but by sharing the insight that she herself has received. Her confidence rests on the conviction that the divine presence can still be encountered directly. This is a subtle but a very powerful challenge to the assumption that the spiritual truth must always be mediated by institutional authorities. Mary's message suggests that while teachers and communities can support the path, the deepest recognition of truth happens within the human heart. For many people today, this idea feels both liberating, but it also feels daunting. The collapse of external certainty can leave individuals feeling spiritually homeless. Yet it also opens the possibility for a more mature relationship with faith, one in which belief is not merely inherited, but consciously explored and embodied. Mary Magdalene's legacy, then, is not primarily one of rebellion against institutions. She's not portrayed as a revolutionary seeking to overthrow structures of authority. Instead, her presence points towards something quieter, but more transformative. Remembrance. Remembrance in the mystical sense means recovering awareness of the divine reality that has always been present. It is the recognition that the sacred is not distant or inaccessible, but woven into the very fabric of consciousness. The illusions described in her vision, the powers that attempt to bind the soul, they represent the layers of fear, confusion, and identification that obscure this recognition. In this light, Mary's teaching offers a spiritual path that feels especially suited to an era of transition. Many people today are disentangling their sense of spirituality from the institutions that once defined it. They are exploring contemplative practices, ancient texts, and interfaith wisdom traditions in search of a more direct encounter with the sacred. Mary Magdalene stands at the crossroads of this search. She represents a form of Christianity that is contemplative rather than coercive, experiential rather than purely doctrinal. Her voice suggests that faith doesn't have to be abandoned in order to become authentic. Instead, it can be deepened by returning to the interior sources from which spiritual insight arises. For those that are navigating the uncertainties of modern spiritual life, Mary's example offers both reassurance and challenge. The reassurance lies in the reminder that the capacity for divine knowing has always existed within the human soul. The challenge lies in the responsibility that accompanies that realization. If truth can be encountered directly, then each person must learn to cultivate the clarity, humility, and courage required to recognize it. In that sense, Mary Magdalene doesn't simply belong to the past. Her voice continues to speak into a moment when many are rediscovering that the deepest spiritual authority is not imposed from outside, but awakened from within. Mary Magdalene was too early for a world that needed control rather than clarity, yet her voice remains not as an accusation, but as an ongoing invitation, an invitation to listen inwardly, to trust discernment, to remember that resurrection is not only an event, it is a constant practice. And perhaps the most radical thing that Mary Magdalene ever did was not to love deeply or to witness faithfully or even to teach courageously, but to speak when she knew she would not be believed.